The ABC Social History Unit presents Roll Your Own Radio, the third program in the series Bright Sparks, Australian Radio Stories, compiled by Stephen Rapley.
The ABC presents The Ham, being a tribute to the amateur enthusiast whose experimental and developmental work in radio has played such a notable part in communication and broadcasting. The Ham. This is their proud story.
Calling BQDX, BQDX, 20-meter phone. This is BK3KU, calling BQDX, BQDX, 20-meter phone,
That's how the ABC began a dramatized feature about amateur radio, broadcast in 1946, shortly after the hams had managed to get back onto the air after the Second World War. It's thanks to an enterprising radio amateur with a disc-cutting machine that we have a copy of the original program. It was a time when people were first hearing of the wartime duty played by radio and its offspring like radar, and of the thousands of service radio operators, many of whom were hams before the war. The ABC drama traced the tradition back to the man it called the first amateur, Marconi.
First, a bell was made to ring. An unseen pulse of energy leapt across the young Marconi's workroom and made a bell ring. A bell. Not a peal of victory bells that might more fittingly have marked such a triumph. Not the deep, exulting note of a bell cast in bronze, but a cheap, clattering, clamorous electric bell that stuttered, stopped, and started again. The first tremulous cry of the wonder child of that inspired mind, wireless, was born. 1895, a few feet. 1896, a few yards. 1897, a few miles.
People could understand the telephone because there was a wire connected. They could understand that by some means a sound would come along the wire. They could understand the telegraph with the dots and the dashes because the signals were running over a wire. But wireless, there was no interconnecting medium. It was absolute magic that somebody could, with turning a little knob, could pick out a voice out of the air from London or anywhere that you could identify. You could hear music in the air. It was absolutely magic, and I think that's really what got people on. And things like sporting things there, where people had no hope of going to see a test match, particularly when they were in London there. But by the flick of a switch and turning of a knob, they could hear that Bradman had made another century.
Jack Ross has written about the history of radio in Australia. He grew up in Toowoomba in the 1920s and 30s.
You had plenty of it, of course, but it took a long time to do anything, to go anywhere, and certainly if you wanted to talk to anybody about wireless problems or anything like that, it was quite an exercise. Nearly all farmers, of course, anybody who had a battery lighting set or anything, they all considered themselves as first-class electrical engineers, and therefore they had a God-given right to be an expert on radio. And, of course, the news still got around, soon got around that, certain man was good at radio, and don't go near this other fella there, he'll blow your valves or something like that there. So, as I said, there were so many, it was so far away where we lived there, that it wasn't possible to become close to anybody or spend so much time with them. So it was a question like people out in the country that you're on your own. You've got most of your information out of your Threepenny magazines and things like that there if you wanted to learn about radio.
Which magazine do you remember reading as a boy?
Oh, well, there was things called Broadcast News, Broadcast Engineering, and, of course, in South Australia, which I also had copies of that time, even though it wasn't in South Australia, the South Australian Wireless Weekly, that was cheap because that was only threepence. And you could find that on the bookstores in Brisbane and that. But nearly every state, certainly capital city, produced magazines. And then there was magazines that came in from England. And, of course, the overseas magazines, like Radio Craft and all those sort of things that came from the United States and the English magazines. There was no shortage of magazines on wireless, just the same as there was no shortage of magazines on all sorts of hobbies.
They called themselves the Ham. In suburban backyards, tall masts rose waveringly into the skies. Wires were spread to catch fragmentary whispers of moss.
This is PK3MP of the present days, but way back in 1908, I can remember when all we could use was the brass staircase rods for the transmitter with spark coils for exciting, and for the receiver we also used brass staircase rods and coherer.
Stan Hoskin, reminiscing on the amateur bands in 1950, about the earliest experimental days in Australia.
About 1909, the crystal came to hand, and later following that was the expedition to the South Pole using Macquarie Island as a base. We were able to receive that at Surrey Hills at a house of A.J. Stocks, who's passed away now. His father was kind enough to build an 80-foot mast for us, and we did all our work there. We used three slide tuners and loose couplers and all the rest that we could think of at the time.
Because Australia was so far from the sources of radio components, for quite a long time, amateur experimenters had to make do and roll their own radios.
In a lot of cases, you had to make your parts because you couldn't buy them. Early on, back in the 20s and early 30s, we did make a lot of parts. It was very necessary at times to make your own capacitors or condensers, as we called them in those days. And you always had your workbench somewhere and a scrap box, a junk box, as the Yanks call it. And it was a case of makeshift, and you made whatever you required. If you couldn't buy it, well, you had to make it, and you just did so.
My first crystal that I made myself was on a bit of insulating material that my father brought home from work to make them for the job. I think it consisted of rotary switches, all handmade, and the knobs on the thing were screw tops off bottles of air oil, filled up with sealing wax and sunk onto the shaft with sealing wax. I remember making all them up, and the contacts on the board were paper clips, the little brass foil paper clips they used, the pointed things. Well, they were all soldered. You drilled a hole, took them in, bent them over the back and soldered the wires on them. They were all the taps on the coils. But it's quite a while ago now. It's getting a bit vague.
And then bits and pieces were made up. I used Meccano set to make brackets on the top of this box to improve things, and somehow or other found a piece of square brass somewhere and wangled something to make a slider, and I had a coil with a slider on it. I even used sacks of salt cardboard containers to wind coils on. Economy dictated most of these things.
Frank Taylor, Jack Sullivan and Jack Seabrook. One of the most complicated components to make was the condenser, especially the variable condenser for tuning. Bob Pine and Otto Sandel.
The foil was just to come off chocolates. Well, you could cut that into little squares and put the tissue paper in between, dip the tissue paper in candle wax and then put that in between and make yourself a capacitor. Another way of making a variable capacitor was two tins like jam tins, one a little bit smaller than the other, and you'd cut them in half lengthwise and rig up a skewer through one of them so you could turn it so that it turned inside the other one. Or you could get two tins of different size and just push one into the other as long as they didn't touch, and that would vary the capacity between them. That was, you know, one way around not having the four and six or whatever it was to buy a capacitor.
You could buy the valves, you made everything else. If it was the tuning condenser, you made it. I made the tuning condensers out of some test tubes that I got from Elliott Brothers. You buy large test tubes, you cut a piece of zinc, bend it round to fit inside, and you built it. You cut another one and made that round to go on the outside. And you soldered a wire onto each one, and the one on the outside you made that the earth one. and you slid that up and down to tune the receiver in or the transmitter in. That's how you made your tuning condenser to tune the thing to the wavelength that you wanted. Even the ones for the receiver. You tuned in with the test tube.
The hams could make radios out of almost anything. Max Lovelace was an operator with the Australian forces fighting in Timor in 1942. With all their radio gear destroyed, Lovelace and a team of signalmen were gradually able to put together a complete transmitting station out of parts raided from behind enemy lines. The radio, known as Winnie the War Winner, built on kerosene tins, is in the Australian War Memorial.
Complete outfits from £5. Honeycomb coils from 6 shillings and 6 pence.
Electrolytic condenser. Electromagnetic
knobs, dials, rheostats, switch arms, ebonite and bakelite panels, cabinets, etc.
Energy.
Switch points.
Ether. Fading.
Thermionic valve.
All crystal 6 and 1.
Super heterodyne.
Crystal filament. Flux. Frequency.
Switch arms are a decent job. 4 and 6.
Microphone.
Grid leak.
Sliders for turning coils.
Round
1 and 9 pence. Terminal 6 pence.
Hand capacity.
Get your name down.
Harmonics.
Price.
Heavy side layer.
Absolute satisfaction guaranteed.
Heptode.
I was interested in radio as a small boy when the only station you could receive here was the spark transmitter in the domain, VIM. And you'd get that at 9 o'clock at night. It would give a time signal. And it'd transmit some shipping information and weather information.
The earliest experimenters tuned into the signals of the coastal radio stations to see how their new receivers worked. Ivor Morgan's first set was as basic as they come.
This was a thing that I could make. Safety razor blades mounted in a piece of wood, and you gently rest a piece of carbon out of a pencil on the, and of course the bad contact creates the rectification, and it was more unstable than a cat's whisker. But just the same, I could receive VIM on that, and a lot of aerial, a pair of headphones, and all this kind of thing. And it was built on a board that was set up in my mother's laundry, and I had to take it down when she wanted to do the washing because it occupied so much space.
Hello, hello, hello. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Speech. The first uncertain words were spoken early in the century. But articulation came slowly until the development of the thermionic tube, the valve, swept the last obstacles aside and the muffled voice broke clearly through.
Hello, hello. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4.
1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. And out of this bedlam, broadcasting was born.
We were, must have been, I suppose, 12 miles or something out of Brisbane, and if I'd saved up sixpence for pocket money, the first thing was I'd go in town and see what I can find. Well, you'd ride your bike or get a lift in there by somebody you knew that was going in there, and you'd spend most of your day with your nose pressed against the glass window there, you know, drooling over, if I could only get another threepence, I could get that. If I'd only had another penny, I could get this, you know. In the end, you'd probably finish up coming away with 6 feet of copper wire or something for another coil or a burnt-out resistance or something like that there that had to be patched up, or a condenser that had all the plates all broken, and you had to patch that up. Well, that's just about all you could get. But to get anything new, like a brand new tuning condenser, you're talking about 17 and sixpence. Well, like that wasn't on, you know, somebody who got tuppence a week pocket money or something like that there. But fortunately, if you showed any interest, a lot of the elderly people who have an interest in wireless, they'd always have some parts in their old box for you if they knew that you were very keen and interested. So you just seem to get these things. without having much money. And I think in the radio clubs, every suburb, nearly every suburb had its radio club, and boys wouldn't miss that for the world. I know there was a radio club not far from us, and rain, hail or snow, we'd go there. Probably didn't understand a word they were talking about, but you just had to be there. It was part of the camaraderie to be amongst those who knew about wireless, hoping that some of it would brush off onto you.
You saw Homecraft, you saw McElroy was the man, you know, and he used to import out a lot of radio stuff from America and England. But did he know how to charge? He certainly did. But eventually, most of us used to go into that shop and have a look at a piece of apparatus, have a good look at it, and we'd make one from it.
Did people sit there and kind of count the number of turns on the coil and work out how the diameter of the coil so they could reproduce it at home?
Well, if you were quick enough, you'd pick up the piece of apparatus and just go like that with your pencil on the top of it, and that gives you an idea how many turns. But sometimes old McElroy was a little bit of a wake up to that, and he stopped that sort of arrangement. But then later on, the little books came out, tell you how to make a tuning apparatus. We didn't worry about McElroy. We didn't worry about him at all. The only thing we did worry about is perhaps used to buy the wire from him and the slider arrangement and what they call a loose coupler, two coils to go inside one another. But he was a wake up, but oh, I used to charge. And his spark business used to charge a lot of money for that. My first spark coil transmitter was from a Ford coil. I used to use a Ford coil for spark transmission. Of course, that was knocked on the head in the latter years because it caused too much interference to broadcast listeners, and they used to complain.
Bill Seavers had a go at making the most complex component of the lot.
I made my own valve in the years gone by, but I was never successful. It didn't last very, very long because I couldn't evacuate the tubular. All I had to do was using a bicycle pump. Well, that wasn't sufficient. And by the time I got what I thought all the air was out of the tube, and I sealed the end of it glass. It lasted for a while, but it didn't last too long because the filament gave away. It worked from a 12-volt, 6-volt or 12-volt, mainly a 6-volt battery in those days.
What did you use to make the valve with?
I used fuse wire. So you can just imagine that wouldn't last very long, depending upon what amperage that battery was given out.
How were you going to seal up the vacuum once you'd pumped it?
Well, a glass blowing arrangement. I started to learn that, as a matter of fact, when our two friends came over to help me, over in Richmond, over here. But we weren't successful, just the same.
For many years, amateurs enjoyed relative freedom on the bands. But after broadcasting began, they were limited to the shorter wavelengths that engineers considered useless. However, as an international group, they quickly discovered that these short waves could cover longer distances.
About 1922... my station made a low-power record that has not since been beaten, as far as I am aware. Using a power of less than that used by a torchlight, I was able to communicate with New Zealand, a distance of 1,200 miles.
Charles McClurkin was interviewed in 1944 by the ABC's Leslie Rees.
Wireless Weekly, at that time, consistently referred to you as our leading experimenter. What other experiments were you conducting about then?
Well, quite apart from broadcasting, I was interested in the shortwave transmissions on low power, and the general trend of experiments was directed in particular to operating on shorter and shorter wavelengths. To help prove my theories, I made an experimental trip to America in 1924, accompanied by a schoolboy experimenter named Jack Davis, who is now one of the engineers in Amalgamated Wireless. This trip was made on the RMS Tahiti, and the object was to see how far communications could be maintained using short wavelengths and very low power. A specially built shortwave transmitter and receiver was installed on the after boat deck of the ship, and the aerial was suspended from the mainmast. The wireless cabin was lifted bodily onto the deck and there lashed in position. The result of this trip was most amazing, and communication was established from my station in Strathfield across the Pacific to San Francisco. In the years following, up to 1927, my station was able to establish direct contact with South Africa and England on a 20-meter wavelength. On the occasion of the English contact, I sent a message to His Majesty King George V from the experimenters of Australia, and in due course received His Majesty's thanks. Getting these results often entailed rising at 3 a.m. for months on end. In 1927, I finally gave up my radio activities, as I had found the world a very small place indeed, having then been in direct communication with all the 5 continents. So I called it a day. Anyhow, Mrs. McClurkin said she had been a wireless widow long enough.
Behind the front line of record-breaking experimenters, there were many amateurs listening in and reporting on the quality of new signals. Frank Taylor grew up in Subiaco in Perth during the 30s. He remembers learning Morse code from a local amateur, Ian Dick.
Initially, we used to work by lights, lamp signalling. He was able to borrow from time to time a Lucas signalling lamp from the his army unit, and he'd set that up in his bedroom on the second story of the place and point that across the backyards, and I would sit in our kitchen and I had a torch, a bullseye type torch, which had a lamp on the side of it, and I had a flat 6 or 9 volt battery, and I used to practice Morse code with him on virtually lamp signalling. Then we really improved because somehow or other I made a buzzer. So we put wires across the backyard from along the fence and to his place, and we used to communicate with the buzzer. And that, of course, gave me a more effective use of Morse code. And, in fact, I recall going out with him in his sidecar on his motorbike on more than one occasion, he in his uniform and me wrapped up in something warm, going to one or two of the night signals exercises that he went on. It was fairly informal, being a reserve situation. I can remember going up to King's Park with him on more than one occasion whilst they were using the Lucas signalling lamps from King's Park to South Perth or somewhere on the other side of the river, and really enjoying that. They'd have the Lucas signalling lamp on a tripod and the battery box and the Morse key and so on, and was I thrilled to see that Morse key, which was a real manufactured one and not something that I'd cooked up myself. Never had one though until after the war when I bought one disposals.
So you kept your little Meccano key?
Oh yes, it was just cooked up on a piece of jarra that I'd scrounged from somewhere, part of a fruit box actually.
My first recollection of being involved in broadcasting as such was 1932 when I was just a schoolboy, about 10 or 11. It was when the English cricketers under Jardine came out here. And, of course, most people can remember the furore that those cricketers caused at that time. And, of course, being a cricket fanatic myself, even at that tender age, all I wanted to do was to listen to every ball-by-ball description of those historic battles. And we lived out in the bush from Brisbane with no amenities whatsoever, no electricity or anything like that. There was a man about a mile or so away from us who had a magnificent 6-valve battery receiver that lit up like a searchlight when he had it on, and I thought this was great, and he knew I liked this cricket. He liked the cricket too, even though he's a farmer. We'd come in when I came home from school and listen to the end of the broadcast, and he encouraged me to become interested in the technical side of it, and he showed me how to build a crystal set using a Bourneville cocoa tin for the coil and with a few scrap parts that he had around the place, and an old single telephone, or for candlestick telephone receiver. We built a set, which I took home, erected an enormous aerial in the back house from the top of a tree onto the chimney of the house, and I was on my own from there. I read everything I could read on radio. I'd spend my threepences on magazines that were around at the time there, and by about 1934, 2 years later, when the Australians were going to England, I considered myself a bit of an expert in radio by then. I'd constructed and dismantled quite a number of crystal sets, and I'd also got to the stage where I'd built some battery sets. So I was preparing myself to listen to these English people, the broadcast direct from England, to listen to all my favourites, the teams. I can still remember many of the names fairly well. I remember there was a stack of people called Bill. There was a Bill Woodfull, of course, the captain, Bill Ponsford, Bill Brown, and Bill Oldfield, the wicket keeper, they were like gods to a young fellow like me. Well, I thought that I'd get onto this English broadcast fairly easily, but of course it wasn't too. I didn't know much about the technicalities. Of course, when I come to pick up shortwave in the BBC, it wasn't on with the Crystal set or the sets that I had. So I talked to poor old Dad into buying what they call then an all-wave set. They'd just come out in 1934 that allowed the ordinary receivers in the home to pick up shortwave broadcasts as well as the standard medium, local medium frequency stations, including 4QG, which is the main one we listen to. Anyhow, Dad raked up the money somewhere, Lord knows where from. We didn't have any money. And we got this magnificent console all-wave receiver. I think it cost £8 or £9, which was an enormous amount of money there. And from then on, it was on all the time till 3 o'clock in the morning, I think it was. And I'd listen to these broadcasts every time they were on there. And even though I was up all night till 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, I'd have an hour's sleep and cut the wood and do what I had to do before I went to work, and I'd be off as happy as a lark, none the worse for not having slept much during the night.
When the ABC feature The Hams was broadcast, it included one of the earliest sounds from outer space. Amateur ingenuity had literally leapt out of this world. On the evening of the 10th of January 1946, three American hams bounced a radio signal off the face of the moon.
2.5 seconds after the signal leaves, you should hear a beep from it. One every 4 seconds.
Yeah, but I don't want to be difficult, Chief, but how we know they're from the moon?
Because it's the only object 40,000 miles from the Earth. The time lag will prove it. Now, if the beeps come back quicker or later than 2.5 seconds, well, it's not the moon we've hit. But if they come back dead on that time, then they're back from the moon. Okay?
Okay.
Ready, sir.
Well, let's get going, then. Now, watch the screen.
There she goes. On your way, buddy.
One, two, there. Did you see it?
No, I guess not.
There's the next one going. Wait, I'll bring up the game.
Wow! Oh, boy! Listen to the moon talking!
Eighteen ninety-five. 1902. 1946. 240,000 miles.
Not bad for the ham.
Full length, full wavelength.
In Roll Your Own Radio, you heard Jack Roth, Stan Hoskin, Frank Taylor, Jack Sullivan and Jack Seabrook, Bob Pine, Otto Sandell, Ivor Morgan and Bill Sievers. Our thanks to Mrs. Ilse Morgan and Chris Long for archival material used in this program. The interview with Charles McClurkin is from the ABC's radio archives, and the program included excerpts from the cassette The Sounds of Amateur Radio, produced by the Wireless Institute of Australia. In the next program, Loudspeakers, we'll hear more about the amateurs and their early broadcasts. Music for the series was written and performed by Kathy Peters, production of Bright Spark, Sharon Davis, Judy Lowry and Stephen Rapley for the ABC's Social History Unit.
The fact was, if you heard music or a noise, somebody speaking, that was magic up there. Distortion was not in the picture. But today, of course, everybody talks about distortion. That's all they want to talk about. If you hear a little scratch, the distortion. If you've got a tape recorder, they say, how much is the wow and flutter? Who ever heard of such rubbish years ago there? And this just goes on and on. And I wonder today whether, in fact, we still get the same enjoyment. I know if I listen to the test from England today via satellite, sometimes I wonder whether I get the same enjoyment out of listening to it as I did 50 years ago when I had my ear glued to the earpiece with static and noise and crackle and all sorts of things going on there. I doubt it.